Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editors of your favorite libertarian magazine gather each Monday to bark about the news and everybody's stimmies. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and a triumphantly returning Peter Suderman. Happy actual spring, comrades.
Howdy, and please never say stimmy again.
I just learned that word. It's your fault.
And you can now stop. You learned it, and you used it, and you're done.
Yeah, I'm with Catherine on this one, Matt Welch. Please stop.
Happy Monday, y'all.
Yeah, nice to have you back, Peter. We're going to talk about not stimmies, but the resurgent immigration crisis at
Zimmy?
The border. It is your fault, Catherine. It is absolutely your fault, objectively. But first, hey, y'all, remember Freedom Fest? The summit for the Liberty Movement has decamped from the formerly freewheeling Las Vegas to South Everlovin' Dakota, the only state to never lock down for even one single day during the pandemic. 1,300 people have already signed up for this year's conference, which takes place July 21st to the 24th in Mount Rushmore, because of course. Why don't you become the next? Go to freedomfest.com to see all the details and speakers lined up for this year's theme of healthy, wealthy, and wise. That's right. You've got John Mackey on the Whole Foods diet, Dr. Drew Pinsky on what America did wrong with COVID-19, which will also be the subject of this year's mock trial. You've got Justin Amash and Joe Jorgensen and Dave Rubin and Tom Woods and Ayaan Hirsi Ali. And of course, Reason Day, featuring your very favorite Reason writers on July 22nd. Early bird rates are just $3.99 per person, $2.99 for guests, $1.49 for students. That's almost free if you act before March 31st. That's pretty soon. Go to freedomfest.com and act now. You'll be glad you did. All right. As we speak, there are more than 15,500 unaccompanied minor migrants in the custody of U.S. Customs and Border Protection and the Department of Health and Human Services along the southern border as the facilities and capacity get overrun, including by people wearing Biden Please Let Us In t-shirts. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said yesterday that U.S.-Mexico border is quote-unquote closed now. Republicans are pouncing, and yes, I use that word, arguing that former President Donald Trump had it right all along. The administration, meanwhile, is pointing out that Trump had effectively ended the asylum process altogether, a decision that they describe as untenable. It's all a big mess. Catherine, let's tee up your anger by not talking about stimmies, but talking about the perhaps. Look, we got to get those guttural noises from you somehow in the first 50 minutes. But reflect, if you will, Catherine, on a bit of magical thinking. And here's how I would tee it up. That, Trump's magical thinking obviously was like build the wall. Mexico will pay for it. And illegal immigration will more or less stop or be drastically reduced. That didn't happen. The Biden magical thinking or the Democratic magical thinking, I would posit, and maybe you'll disagree, is you can restart the asylum process, stop deportations, and not have what you have right now on the southern border. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, the very first thing I want to say is we could solve this problem by letting them in. We could just let them in. We could freaking let them in. We could let families who have shown up at our border desperate to come and make lives in our country in. We could give them COVID tests and deny them benefits and do whatever else needs to be done to let them in. Then there wouldn't be a crisis at the border. There would just be an orderly line to enter. That would be better. Okay. Sorry.
So no stimmy? No stimmy for
if
the
asylum?
If we need
to deny
I just want
the
to double
asylum
check on
seekers the stimmy, then fine. That would be a deal I would make. Me and Brian Kaplan would make that deal. Okay. Sorry, just had to start there because I do think it's actually important to start all these conversations there. There's this weird thing, even among people who think of themselves as pro-immigration, that's like, well, the thing we certainly can't do is let people in. So then we have to deal with the big mess that cascades from there. And that's just wrong. We could let people in. But yes, of course, you are right about the incentives that have been created by Biden getting elected and campaigning on being more open to immigration. He very clearly campaigned on many, many dimensions, saying that he would not repeat the mistakes of the Trump administration in using draconian techniques at the border. So far, he has basically done what Trump did at the border with a few key exceptions. And I give him full credit for each and every one of those exceptions, including the executive orders he signed at the beginning in the first week of his term that did reopen a couple categories of immigration, including stuff for Dreamers and stuff for unaccompanied children. But we are specifically incentivizing people sending their children alone across the border. That's what's happening right now. We are separating people from their children still, although it's happening in a slightly different mechanism than it did under Trump, and then keeping them in boxes so we can figure out what to do with them. Cages, if you like, tents, if you don't, whatever, pick your word. We have created disaster incentives and we are now reaping the results of that. There is an easy solution, and it is too bad that we have no political party between the two mainstream parties that will endorse that solution.
Peter Suderman, to that point, Nancy Pelosi blames this on Trump. Kevin McCarthy blames this on Biden. I would point out that both of them work in a little place we like to call the House of Representatives, which could, in theory, pass legislation pertaining to our policies. Can you reflect a little bit about what role Congress has at all, ever, about anything, but specifically about the laws that govern immigration?
Well, I like that you add in theory there. I think that's important. You know, in theory, theory works all the time. In practice, not so much. And that's sort of what we're looking at with the House of Representatives here. In theory, they can always pass legislation. In practice, they are going to pass, $1.9 trillion worth of stimmies and give them out to people that just to make Catherine Mangu Ward mad. I think you noted that there is a sort of a cross-partisan blame game going on here. And while normally the position on this podcast is when that happens, that everybody involved is wrong. In this case, I think it's kind of that everybody's right. This is, in some ways what we're seeing at the border right now isn't remarkable. One of the notable features about complaints, during the Trump administration about complaints about kids in cages, which we heard all the time during the Trump administration, was that you'd see these images passed around on social media. And at least in a couple of cases, the attached photos were photos from the Obama era. There were facilities that the Obama administration built or helped fund or, was involved in some way. Trump absolutely amplified Obama's policies. He took what Obama was already doing and did it harder and meaner and worse, particularly where it came to the zero tolerance policies for undocumented immigration and child separations, which was just a tool born out of cruelty. It was designed to be cruel and inhumane as a punishment and a discouragement to immigrant families. But the point is, Trump may have kicked it up a notch, but in many ways, what he did was to extend and expand on the existing Obama administration policy. And since Biden is in many ways a kind of a Obama 2, right? He's a sequel. He's the next phase in the Obama expanded universe in many ways. It's not surprise that he's just giving us more of the same here, which means more kids in cages, which means more children basically held prisoner in incredibly inhumane conditions, unable to clean themselves, unable to talk to their parents, often just sort of held for a week or more in some cases without really knowing what their fate or their future is going to be. And it's cruel and it's inhumane regardless of which party does it.
Nick, I saw some chatter among journalists on the social media machinery over the weekend.
Which is destroying America, by the way, Matt.
It's already destroyed. We're done. It's Earth that has been salted. But complaining that I think one of the Good Morning America type of programs had decamped to the border, and like, my God, why are you people doing this? Don't you know we just passed a $1.9 trillion stimmy and other things that are really
not how we that's not how we now. Use that word, just for the record. The stimmy only refers to the money that appeared in your bank account. That's the stimmy. The whole thing is still the COVID relief
full
bill.
Of stimmies.
No, because
the American Rescue Plan,
as the
Act.
Associated Press has told us, it's not a stimulus.
So don't call it a stimulus. Okay.
I'm inviting you, Mr. Gillespie, to reflect on
Matt,
the
please correct yourself.
Doctor.
Thank
sorry,
you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Dr. Jill Biden, please let us know what you think about this.
Yes. No, on the differential, I mean, both Peter and Catherine kind of referenced it, the, you know, kids in cages versus non-kids in cages, depending on who the president is. Is that just us being irritable jerks?
You know, I remember a time, Matt, when it was girls in cages, and there were movies with people like Mamie Van Doren. Your personal hero.
Were they dancing?
She is.
Is this like a go-go
sometimes,
situation?
Mostly fighting, sometimes dancing.
Unless it is a go-go environment. Yeah. We are against people
in
cages.
I was actually, just to drive this down the rabbit hole,
yes.
Floating down the Rio Grande, I was watching a video with Mr. Ray Manzarek, a professor of rockology, who was talking about when The Doors and Jim Morrison, who was tripping on acid, performed the end for the first time extemporaneously at the Whiskey A Go-Go, Matt Welch, the legendary Whiskey A Go-Go on the Sunset Strip or nearabouts, that even the go-go girls in the cages who were paid to dance stopped dancing because they were witnessing history.
Matt Either Welch. That or it was the lewds. To be honest,
I
cannot
agree.
Emphasize how quickly my brain shut off when Nick started talking. Yeah. I literally don't know what he just said.
Hey, you know what? Nobody asked you to come back. Why are you back online? Are you, I thought you're like a Westworld host, you know? You're offline.
Doesn't look like anything
that
to me.
That was the command, the Siri command, just to go offline. You know, two things, Matt, real quickly about all of this, which is god awful. And Catherine is absolutely right that, you know, we're spending an untold sum of money to fix all the evils in the world, and they can't like spend a little bit more money to get more capacity at Motel Sixes, you know, in McAllen, Texas, or something like that. It is insane. And Joe Biden, this is a preview. We're told, oh, Joe Biden is competent. Joe Biden, you know, Joe Biden, Joe Biden, Joe Biden. He's an idiot, and he didn't know what he was doing, and he's just replicating at a bigger level, at a dumber level, what preceded him. And that's the preview of the next 4 years or 4 months or however long he keeps going before he's, you know, the next time he exits Air Force One, I guarantee you he's going to be shoved out the window out the door by Kamala Harris. So that's point one. The second
point.
That was
a joke about him tripping,
is that Donald Trump's.
And not tripping balls.
I would love to see him trip. Yeah, if he was tripping, I don't know. Well, the second point is that Donald Trump's signature achievement as president ultimately was to turn the country, after going through a lot of weird gyrations, away from being anti-immigrant, and we saw this in the 90s in California and elsewhere, into the most pro-immigrant that we have ever been. By the time Trump was leaving office, about 75% of Americans, 85% of Democrats, 65% of Republicans agreed, according to Gallup, that immigrants were good for the country. Immigration was good for the country. Joe Biden ran on that platform, and he should be, you know, and the Democrats should do this. Like, they should actually introduce immigration reform along the lines that Catherine was saying and Peter was hinting at, you know, open the border, make it easier for people to move and live here legally. They don't get this, their STEMI, they don't get benefits, they don't get this, they don't get that, but let more people live here legally, openly, pay taxes, all of that kind of stuff. It is a electoral winner, but the Democrats don't really care about immigrants, and that's why there will be no movement on this. You know, and the other thing is it'll be nice to see if the Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, actually lets reporters into these facilities, because they're following a golden rule of the Trump era, which is to keep, you know, the press out of what's actually going on.
Catherine, I'd like you to address a couple of common objections to your point of view. One is that the asylum process has become this great loophole under which people can say, hey, look, I was persecuted at home. I was menaced by gangs.
My parents just don't understand.
My parents
so
just
I
don't understand
hitchhiked
me.
North.
All I wanted was a Pepsi. And so they show up on the border. And so we need to, thank you. Never forget. So people are using this loophole to come in that don't actually fulfill the spirit of the asylum laws. That's one. Two is that during a time of an international pandemic, especially one now where it's going up like crazy in places like Brazil, and in fact, even in the European Union, places that haven't had the same kind of vaccination levels, that there is an extra reason to want to control incoming traffic. And then just three, if you get all the immigrants to come in, they're going to vote Democrat and get more stimmies.
Yeah, so I'm going to ignore three because this isn't a question for partisan business. I am going to answer two, which is that I think that this is in some ways the most legitimate objection at this precise moment to the case for open borders. We are in the middle of a global pandemic still. I guess hopefully we're not in the middle of it. We're toward the end of it, I would like to think. But, you know, we have COVID tests. And by the way, we also have vaccines. So again, if our imperative was solve the humanitarian crisis at the border, we could test people before letting them in. Having them sit for a few days waiting for two rounds of testing would still be much, much, much better than our current arrangement. Or heck, we could vaccinate them. Double heck, we could vaccinate them with the AstraZeneca vaccines that we're giving to Mexico anyway. We made a deal on Thursday. Nope. We made a deal on Thursday to give Mexico some of these AstraZeneca vaccines we've been sitting on because they are approved for use there. And in exchange...
So what's triple heck going to be?
I am out of hex. But I do actually want to answer the first question, which is the idea that the current use of asylum laws is a loophole. I think I am tempted to answer that two different ways. My first answer is like, no, this is absolutely the spirit of asylum laws. There are lots of ways that people can be in danger in their home countries. And just because we made a little specific list at some point of what's like real need for asylum versus not real and occasionally politicize that list, you know, who cares? If you're in danger, come here. We try to have people be safe and healthy here. So come on over. But if you want to take the question on its own terms and say, okay, listen, it's true. We designed asylum laws to do one thing and they are now doing a much bigger thing. Fair enough. The way you solve that is the heart of the crisis right now with the Biden transition, which is we are not doing a good job of clearly and consistently communicating our standards for immigration. People around the world don't know exactly what is going to get them in or get them thrown out of the United States. And because it is so valuable to come here, they give it a try. The way that we solve people aggressively using the asylum quote unquote loophole is to very, very, very clearly telegraph who is eligible for asylum. Right now, we are doing a terrible job of that and we're changing it every 4 or 8 years.
So Catherine is just a recruiter for MS-13. I see. That's the only
this is a thing, right? Like, yeah. I think the history of the United States is not a history of us saying, wow, we really screwed up when we let in more of demographic X. It's a history of always assimilating and celebrating those people's culture once we're here. Now, have we screwed up in specific immigration decisions or visa decisions? Like, yeah, we probably shouldn't have let those hijackers come here and learn how to fly planes. That was not our finest hour. But that's not a demographic decision. That's not a category decision. There will always be individuals that that we wished we hadn't let in. But that I do think that it's just not the case that if we did dramatically expand legal immigration, we would look back later and be like, oh, yeah, we screwed up.
Oh, if anything, it would be the opposite, you know, and the, you know, just for instance, think of around 1920, in the mid-20s, immigration from Europe was essentially cut off. How many Jews died because they couldn't make it into the United States? How many, did we miss by not, you know, by cutting off Italy, Southern Europe, Central Europe? More to the point, this asylum loophole is a great thing because asylum is a process. And basically from the countries that are sending kids, and this is like Honduras and El Salvador and Mexico, it's under 10% of the asylees are granted. There's a process in place and it's currently taking almost 2 years to go through this because for all of the money that we spend on everything, they're not allocating money to immigration processing courts and things like that. The other thing that is amazing is when you look at the asylees who come across the border and then were granted as families or as children were granted provisional staying in the United States. It was something like 90% and 95% of the people showed up for their court procedures, knowing the odds were totally stacked against them, and they were probably going to be sent back to their what Donald Trump felicitously called shithole countries. They showed up for the proceedings anyway. This is a very lawful process, and it should be what we need. This is a place where the government should be spending more on this and less on virtually everything else, you know, and it's maddening. And it is disgusting that people just treat, you know, the poor children of foreign countries as not mattering. That's, you know, that's un-American.
Let's graduate to a related topic, which is that another big kind of policy application of Trump's America First program or reflex was obviously on international trade. Biden, now that he has replaced Trump, has not yet touched Trump's 25% national security tariff on steel. In fact, his first trade action was to reinstate tariffs on aluminum that comes from the United Arab Emirates. Peter Suderman's capable replacement, Eric Boehm, recently wrote that Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo had said during an interview on MSNBC this month that, quote, the data shows that those tariffs have been effective. Peter, are we seeing that Bidenomics is kind of Trumpism with better lipstick?
I don't even know if the lipstick's better, man. I mean, it's a pig either way, right? And it's Biden. This is not a surprise, right? In the same way that it's not that much of a surprise that Biden is pursuing Trump-esque policies at the border because Trump pursued Obama-esque policies at the border. It's even less of a surprise that Biden, who ran on this stuff, who campaigned on basically a Trump-style approach to trade, is now keeping Trump's trade policies in place. And this is, you know, as always, effectively a tax on American consumers. And when Raimondo says the data shows that those tariffs have been effective, what in the world does effective mean? I mean, what it is effective at doing is raising costs for American consumers. You've got estimates that say that the costs range anywhere from $57 billion to $80 billion. I mean, it's a tax increase, no matter how you look at it. And of course, it's always done in the name of protecting American businesses and American jobs, right? But the actual effect is going to be that because of these cost increases for manufacturers in the United States, they're going to actually have to shed jobs. This is going to eliminate jobs and kill jobs. And all of this is part of what, you know, has already been raised here, which is Biden's new industrial policy, which in many ways is an expansion of, maybe even a realization of, the kind of populist, protectionist economic policy that Trump ran on and talked about so much. You know, Biden may not be out there saying MAGA, make a great America great again. He might not be mouthing, you know, America first at big rallies, but he is governing as if he is, right? It's the policy implications are very much the same. And what all of this points to is that Biden, like Trump before him, is closing America off from the rest of the world. He is restricting immigration. He is restricting trade. The Biden administration wants to shrink the geographic scope of American economic activity, of personal movement and freedom. And all of this is done in the name of uplifting ordinary Americans and protecting American businesses. But what it really does is impoverish them. It shrinks the universe of choices for everyone. And it's bad.
Catherine, isn't this just a big libertarian once again? And that's like big government, big military, big libertarian.
Libertarian industrial complex.
Thank you. Isn't it just all you people celebrating the hollowing out of America's jobs in the heartlands?
Right.
You bastards.
Yeah. I mean, the neoliberals have been in charge for too long, as we know. The libertarians have been running America for all these years, and their model has been tried, and it's failed. And thank God that now we have a coalition of Donald Trump and Joe Biden really reeling that stuff back. Like, that narrative is bananas. And I do think a lot of people, in a kind of somewhat unexamined way, believe it. So I guess I do see part of Reason's job as not just reminding people, you know, there's a headline on CNBC that popped up on my phone this weekend that just said U.S.-China trade relations remain strained as Biden team takes tough stance similar to Trump. And I just find it very difficult to believe that people who voted for Joe Biden thought they were voting for this. They, you know, we have seen in polling that support for free trade and immigration, by the way, are higher than they have been in a long, long time, particularly among Democrats. Now, how much of that was screw Donald Trump and how much of that was a genuine shift in opinion? Unclear. We're about to find out, because right now the Democratic president is acting an awful lot like the Republican one before him on these issues, which particularly immigration, people see as a humanitarian issue and a moral issue. Trade, I think people see as a more technical issue. They sort of want to maximize the area under the curve if they think about it at all. But yeah, I think Americans tell pollsters they like free trade, and they certainly have benefited from it for the last several decades. And so I struggle still to understand why there is no political constituency for opening up trade anymore. Like, maybe it was never a huge and robust constituency, but there was at least enough to sometimes push in that direction. And now I'm not seeing it at all.
NBC News ran a headline yesterday that just says, "Why China may be the last bipartisan issue left in Washington." And that just goes, first of all, it's not the last bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
And second of all, it goes to your point that there is no political constituency for openness and for a pro-trade approach, because so much of
this is about China
and about trade with China.
At the same moment that people are telling pollsters that there is, like, they're like, telling pollsters, I like these things and would vote for someone who endorses them. And at least I think many people might reasonably have interpreted Biden's campaign promises as being more pro-immigration and to some extent more free trade. And
I don't think he was more free trade on the campaign trail. He was maybe more pro-immigration rhetorically, but I think it was actually pretty clear going back to the primary that Biden was not going to meaningfully change Trump's trade policies. He basically said, I want to use tariff policy to manage trade with the rest of the world. And even if that means tweaking and changing some of that at the margins, right? It's not that he's necessarily going to pursue exactly to the number every single tariff that Trump pursued. You know, it's not that the policies are going to remain utterly unchanged for the next 4 years, but it is that Biden is going to use the tools of tariffs, of taxes at the border, of restrictions on economic activity that goes across the border, to try and manage the American economy and to, you know, again, to do this in the name of protecting American jobs and American consumers, when in fact what it does ultimately is it reduces American jobs and it harms consumers. It makes life worse for everybody. But that's the argument he's going to make. And it's going to be a very Trumpy argument, just stripped of kind of the Trumpian flourishes.
During the the Trump years, actually, Democrats started outpolling Republicans in terms of being in favor of free trade. And that was partly because they were reacting to Trump. If Trump was for something, they're against it, and vice versa. What happened, and Matt Welch, you're old enough to remember the moments when, starting in the early 90s, it had been people like Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and Republicans made explicit both ideological as well as pragmatic and economic arguments in favor of free trade. And there was a huge momentum capping a movement in favor of free trade that started really in a big way after World War II, but caught fire in the 70s. The ideological arguments were won, and then they were capped by Bill Clinton and especially Al Gore going on and challenging H. Ross Perot on CNN, on Larry King Live. He decimated H. Ross Perot, who seemed at that point to be the last stand of protectionism. He was the guy who talked about the giant sucking sound at the southern border of America because of NAFTA and things like that. And Al Gore made, with charts and everything, just like H. Ross Perot had, he made a very powerful and convincing argument in favor of free trade. By the end of the 90s, protectionism and nativism had popped up again in the form of the anti-World Trade Organization protests and things like that. And what happened was George W. Bush, starting with him, the Republicans fell asleep at the switch. They did not actually promote ideologically or pragmatically or using economic data the benefits of free trade because I think this was partly an outgrowth of the war on terror. We became a fortress America. We started talking about hardening the contours of the country, the exterior, you know, the boundaries of the country to people and to goods and services. Because you know what? Like, just you're going to be bringing in box cutters, you know, from China that then are used by immigrants in order to kill America or something like that. And what we need, because people are generally in favor of free trade, what we need are politicians in particular making explicitly ideological and pragmatic arguments about this. And they have gone missing because all of the concentrated kind of political interest groups, such as unions, are anti-trade.
I've become, in my senescence, more interested in political branding than I was before, or even activist branding. And I can't help but think that there was a threshold crossed when, under the presidency of George W. Bush, we got into our political lexicon and governing lexicon the word homeland. In there. Suddenly we have a Department of Homeland Security. Of course, we're going to be going more Fortress America as a result of that. And even now, just at the border, that's it. It's the homeland is right there in the middle of all of it. All right, we're going to suspend the rules of the Senate here.
Oh my God, it's an emergency, state of emergency on the recent Roundtable podcast, Matt Welch, you monster.
And now that the Cromwell state of emergency has been declared, it will be permanent. Yeah. Matt is the new dictator of the podcast.
Thank you.
He's the chancellor.
Either that or it's the halfway point and we have an ad to read. We're going to talk about the horrific massage parlor murder spree in Atlanta in a moment. But first, are you having a hard time getting through it all, Nick? Getting weighed down by depression, anxiety, sleeplessness, hopelessness, Peter. There's hope for all of us, brothers and sisters. Please consider visiting betterhelp.com/roundtable. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what I need with my March Madness bracket after UCSB lost. It gives you instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Go to their website, betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues, your preferred delivery systems, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that first counselor, you can switch them out. Financial assistance is also available. It's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did.
Hey, Matt, if yes, I sir. May, I think I've done this in the past and without any compensation, but BetterHelp is a great service. I've used it myself. It is phenomenal. It's one of the demonstration projects of the shift onto online everything that makes the world a better place. Highly recommended.
Awesome. Thank you. So last week, a deranged young man murdered 8 people at 3 massage parlors in Atlanta, telling police afterward that he was a religious fundamentalist or fervent believer, tortured by his inability to resist sexual temptation. This was then largely portrayed in the media as being primarily an anti-Asian hate crime, part of an alleged spike in such violence over the past year. As usually happens after a horrific mass murder, Catherine, the narrative wars just kicked into gear. I guess maybe we can thank someone that it wasn't immediately about guns this time or gun policy this time. But it strikes me as just so strange that we have to immediately make this an argument about media and what we call things. What's your sense of watching the way that both journalism is covered and that people have talked about this terrible, terrible murder?
Yeah, I made a few dark jokes myself in those first hours after that shooting about how, well, at least it's a twist on the gun control forever response, which we really had become habituated to a couple years back. There was this almost reflexive call for regulating, I don't know, some kind of gun, any kind of gun, doesn't really matter where the gun came from in the shooting, doesn't matter whether any of the proposed reforms would have made a difference in that. Let's regulate the guns. And there was, I think I'm right in saying, almost none of that. I saw none of that. And there is nothing about the shooting itself that should have caused that differential outcome. Because even in, you know, in past years, there's often a secondary discussion about potential bias or, you know, some kind of animus on the part of the shooter toward a demographic group. But that was always paired with these calls for gun control. So I don't quite know how to read that, actually. It's a little bit of a surprise, because in some ways you might think under a new administration that people would think a call for gun control might actually be heeded and that this would be a moment for that. Instead, we went full, we pivoted to race. We went straight there, including a big contretemps over the police captain, the spokesman who briefed reporters after the shooting about what the shooter had said to investigators. Robbie Suave has a piece on the Reason site about whether the quote that he was having a bad day was a paraphrase or a characterization and whether or not that matters. So the discourse is already 18 levels down. But I do think in some ways that it's better for us to just have a casual chat about anti-Asian racism instead of calls for gun control. At the same time, I have been surprised at how that narrative went all the way from the top, all the way to the bottom instantly. I got an email from my kid's school this morning saying, we condemn anti-Asian violence, which, like, okay, me too. But it is not in any way clear at this point in the investigation, and maybe will never be clear, because you have to have a whole bunch of problems to do something like this. It maybe will never be clear whether that was the central feature in this shooting. And it is quite peculiar to me that we all just decided it was and moved forward with that all the way down to emails from my kid's principal.
I got an email from the new chancellor of the Department of Education in New York City talking about the horrific anti-Asian hate crimes we've been seeing citywide and this week in Atlanta, make it clear that we must work harder to end systemic racism. Always happens with this. Nick, you are a fallen Catholic.
Catholics are fallen, Matt. That's
thank you.
That's the whole thing about Catholicism, right?
The Lamb of God takes away the sins of the world.
If I ever like go full wafer eating, Nick, I look forward
to
falling.
You're like, what, 6 weeks away, Matt Welch?
We're all fallen, but Nick has the extra credit of being
to the Catholic,
lapsed,
right? You're going to mass, you're hanging out, you're starting to wear dresses. I don't know.
Starting? Yeah. No, this maybe is a stupid cheap jack theory, likely since I'm about to say it, but like it's as if people are just desperate for meaning. It's terrifying. And this is true also of COVID response. People want this there to be a morality play that's easily understandable about why it's this works here and this doesn't work there. It's got to be about personal behavior rather than the weather and the wind and whatnot. We're just terrified of not having an explanation in this world.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think so. And, you know, you cannot minimize the horror of this shooting spree. I mean, it is so messed up. And it's also, I think it's hard to explain in the sense of it seems to be driven by a kind of sexual neuroses or a sexual psychosis that ceased to exist for all intents and purposes sometime in by the 1990s. You have a shooter who is acting out something from a Flannery O'Connor short story or something like that, somebody who is, you know, pre-sexual revolution, psychotically at war with his body and his biological urges, listening to the voice of God. I mean, this is, it's an old narrative, and I don't think it makes sense. The other thing, you know, so you look for some reason in, you know, insanity. It's kind of like, you know, it faded from view, but the Las Vegas shooter, if you remember, who opened up, which I think is still the single largest mass killing, certainly in recent memory, there, you know, ultimately people stopped paying attention to that story because no motive kind of emerged that was at all convincing. It's just that even begins to make sense of things. And I think that is part of what's going on here. It's also true that In the immediate aftermath of COVID coming over here, you did have people, really bad actors like Donald Trump, you know, calling it the Wuhan flu and the Chinese flu, et cetera, trying to stoke some kind of nativist feeling. People in America, and this is true of, you know, Democrats as well as Republicans, are eyeing China. And then, you know, because we're kind of stupid people, all Asians somehow become kind of the enemy, and that's a problem. But you also do have a study that came out just before this, which purported to show a massive increase in anti-Asian hate crimes over the past year. And this was based on findings in 16 major cities. And overall, last year, according to the same study, hate crimes went down by 7%. But hate crimes against Asian Americans went up by 150%. When you look at those numbers, something weird emerges because it's basically New York had 28 incidents of hate crimes against Asians in the past year, and that's up from 3 the year before. So that's a real change, but it's also like when you're looking at absolute numbers, we're still talking about excruciatingly small, thank God, moments. And most of those hate crimes were not physical violence either. But this is, I mean, this is part of what, you know, people are using to make sense. I also think, you know, to be very cynical about it, ethnic groups in the wake of Black Lives Matter and Black Lives Matter kind of taking over all of the ethnic rage moment over the past summer because of George Floyd and things that came out of that, other ethnic groups, Latinos, Asians, what have you, are looking for a way back into that conversation.
Ooh, that's a,
and to flex a little
that's
bit.
That's a smoke.
I know, but I think that's true because you suddenly you have America has a it among its very worst immigrant histories is being anti-Asian, anti-Chinese and anti-Japanese and anti-South Asian Indians, you know, spectacularly. Post-World War II, that is not really the reality.
So,
but you can call on that in order to conjure up a specter of something that is truly ugly in American history, but it doesn't quite fit now. But if you want to try and make that case, that's what you're going to be going for.
I do think there's a little asterisk on that. You're right, Nick, that America's peak of anti-Asian sentiment is now quite a long time ago. At the same time, Liz Nolan Brown has done some really good reporting and writing on the ways that our sex trafficking panic has a bunch of really deep and troubling kind of anti-Asian overlay to it. And the fact that this was a massage parlor where the victims were largely Asian, that immediately triggers this whole cluster of associations that include some pernicious anti-Asian stereotypes about, you know, submissive women being trafficked and, you know, happy endings and all this business, exotic oriented. And so I do think from that perspective, I understand why people went there. Like the fact that people went there is itself evidence of an existing anti-Asian racism, especially with respect to sex workers. If these women were sex workers, which we don't actually know at this point. And I think it's worth acknowledging that. It just still strikes me as deeply weird that despite what we know from the shooter himself via third hand, right, the investigators told the spokesman who told us, he says that race wasn't an element of it. And, you know, normally when people do racist killings for the racist reasons explicitly, they like to tell you about that. They write manifestos. They say so. Now, could racism, implicit bias, subconscious racism be a part of this crime? Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth talking about that, but not, again, to me, at the level of elementary school principals sending emails about it. And I think if we wanted to talk about anti-Asian racism in the wake of COVID, we should just talk about that. We could just say like, yo, COVID has made people a bit weird about China. Let's talk about it instead of using this anomalous thing as the vehicle.
The other thing that we should just raise here is just that the alleged shooter appears to have been steeped in kind of conservative evangelical sexual purity culture. And there is, you know, sort of the term of art for this is purity culture, right? This is a thing that evangelicals know about and talk about. And it is, it's a weird and kind of neurotic, obsessive, kind of life-controlling approach to Christian teaching about sexual morality. And I grew up not quite embedded in it, but certainly in the vicinity of it. It was all around me, and, you know, participated in it to the extent that, like, it was part of my world and part of my social milieu. So I knew people that were involved in it, you know, at my church, at the Christian college that I went to for a couple of years. And it is just, you know, at very best, it is deeply weird and perception altering when you are embedded in this world, and when you view sexuality and the human body and its desires and sort of its just things that are basic and natural about what people want out of life and what bodies sort of ask of ourselves. It's perception altering, and at worst, it expresses itself as a kind of psychological malady, as a real derangement about sex and sexuality, that I think for people who are already troubled can be really quite damaging. And again, I'm not saying I know what happened here or why it happened. Like Matt says, you know, we have this collective desire to have a clear story and a clear explanation whenever something horrific happens like this. And that desire is expressed even more profoundly in the media, which has to tell a story not only about what is happening, but about why. And certainly in our kind of activist media age, where a certain kind of journalist or just plain old activist wants to put that explanation to political use, right? That desire to put these things to use, to make them, to make this, you know, sort of power a pre-existing cause and give evidence to something that you already sort of felt, tends toward monocausal explanation. Right? It means that you've got to simplify what happened, and you've got to shave off all the rough edges and the complexities of human derangedness, right? And I just think that we need to learn as a society, journalists need to learn to reject monocausal explanations and to be comfortable with ambiguity and uncertainty in the world, and to just understand that some things cannot be explained by one clear answer that just captures all of it, that many answers are often true or sometimes no answer, as in the case of the Las Vegas shooter. And it's uncomfortable. It's deeply uncomfortable. I don't love it. I like explaining things. I like understanding how they work and why. I do not like a world in which horrible, horrible things happen, or even just like normal things happen, and I cannot explain them. But that is the world we live in, and we need to find some sort of way to talk about that. And I don't think we're very good at it.
I do think it's worth, in the wake of this, though, too, is to, you know, do take a moment to, like, you know, just sit with the dead bodies and the horror of this, independent of other contexts or other overlays that we want to put in it. But it is, you know, when you go back to something like the Kitty Genovese murder, things like the Omar Mateen shooting at the Pulse nightclub, you know, things like Columbine, very quickly a media narrative often becomes, which seems to draw from sociology and, you know, some kind of like legitimate insights, is revealed, it becomes law, not just custom collective memory, but it often and starts laws, things like that, and is shown to be wrong. And I mean, so, you know, yes, Peter, absolutely, we need to hold the media to a higher level of scrutiny in exactly in these kinds of cases, when people are saying, how dare you question, you know, the fact that America is a fall, you know, essentially what's coming out is America is a fallen racist country that hates all foreigners as well as, you know, minorities, racial minorities and whatnot. And, you know, and it's just, it's not supported by the facts. And we need to insist on a world that is much more complicated than we want.
And yet there is a real history of anti-Asian racism. Like, that's embedded in American society. That is part of our approach to, in particular, to Asian personal services and businesses, right? And, you know, I would just, again, commend everyone who is listening to this to go read Elizabeth Nolan Brown's piece from March 2020, Massage Parlor Panic.
Okay. It's time for our listener question of the week. Remember, send us your queries via email at roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Artie Fleischer, if that's your real name. Greeting from the People's Republic of Vermont. During most military campaigns, a common and legitimate question from our politicians is, how do we define victory and what is our exit strategy? I would love to hear someone ask the Biden administration and Dr. Fauci and, of course, Dr. Jill Biden such questions, presumably referring to COVID-19 pandemic and such like. That's from Artie Fleischer. Peter, to the extent that you are still with us sonically, do you want to take first swing?
Yeah, I mean, I think in one sense, it's just a numbers game. You know, we've been looking at whether transmission is relatively low, but I think much more important is whether deaths and hospitalizations are low and manageable. You know, some of the hype about hospitalization overload has been overblown over the past year, but hospital capacity has been a real issue at times in some locales, and we can't have a health system that is occasionally just overwhelmed in waves. That's not tenable going forward. Deaths, I think, are the most important issue. COVID should not be a leading cause of death in the United States, as it has been most weeks, certainly for the last couple of months and throughout much of the last year. It shouldn't be the leading cause of death on any given day or during any season or any month. You know, I think the best way to capture the seriousness of COVID is not even to look at the 500,000 plus people who have died from COVID, but just to look at excess mortality, the number of deaths beyond what's typical. And the toll of the last year has just been horrific. And what we want is for that number to come back down to normal. And when that those numbers come back down, I think that's going to be a good sign that we are past this. But in another sense, it's not just numbers. It's also psychological. And I will say we are victorious when we treat COVID, which won't be eliminated for a while and maybe not ever, just as a normal and tolerable part of life, one that does not require the suspension of normal activities or panic, because deaths are way down, immunity is widespread, people have been vaccinated, we know how to handle variants because we have a process for approving booster shots, that sort of thing. And finally, relatedly, it's also about policy. You know, we're already hearing worries about a fourth wave and new variants. That's creating pressure to extend business closures and restrictions on gathering here in the U.S., in Europe, which is far behind the U.S. in vaccination. There are widespread new lockdowns going into place. We have to get to a place where modest changes in transmission rates and other associated figures just don't cause the public or policymakers to react by clamping down on public life.
Matt, if I may add, the true victory will, it'll be like the U.S., the last helicopter out of Saigon. When those kids in the Wenatchee State of Washington High School band are let out of those zippered up little plastic enclaves that they were playing their wind
free
instruments.
Free the band in. Kids. That's,
you know, when those kids are finally let out. And that builds on what Peter was talking about. Psychologically, this is the question, because, you know, kind of in a public health way, all of the things have been put in place that are killing COVID and whatnot. But psychologically, that's the real victory that is going to be much harder to find, because we have created a world in which, under the pretext of public health and 2 weeks to flatten the curve, you can have the government at all levels take complete control of the economy and of our daily lives, our education, et cetera, and screw with us.
Yeah, my exit strategy is that I have exited and not gonna be putting up with this anymore. Let's go to our end of podcast cultural recommendations and consumptions and whatnot. Catherine, do you want to lead us first in prayer?
I would love to. I want to recommend to you all, particularly those who are fans of my occasional woo rockets interjections on these podcasts, I want to recommend to you a new book called Liftoff, Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX. It's by Eric Berger. He is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, which, I'm not going to lie, is the only job title I've ever heard that sounds better than my current one. And it's really good. It's really readable. I would say the narrative is, it's largely about the Falcon 1 rocket. The Falcon 1 rocket is the center of the narrative. So it's the first three failed attempts to launch and the fourth successful one. Obviously, you know how this story is going to end, so there's not a lot of tension in there. But Berger does just an incredible job of giving you the right amount of access and kind of the right amount of look at what it was really like to be a part of the team that built this.
So does he tell us how we colonized the
moon? Yeah, that's the epilogue. But the best thing about this book, I would say, is that it's not about Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a character in this book. He is a fascinating character in this book. But I think Berger had a limited amount of access, which he used well, but he didn't get totally co-opted by the cult of Elon. And instead, it's about all these wackadoodle engineers who are like, didn't see their families for 6 years and, you know, rebuild everything from scratch a whole bunch of times. And there's a couple of mentions of the Ayn Rand sprinkled out throughout this book, which I think explains something. Like, there's really some John Galt vibes in there, which I enjoyed. So liftoff for the space nerds. If you're a big, big space nerd, you're not going to learn anything new from this book, but you will still enjoy it as I did. And I commend it to you.
Would you describe yourself as a big space nerd?
Yes, I would.
Catherine, I command you now to write a book called Wackadoodle Engineers. I think I would compulsively
read
that.
Can I co-author it with Bob Poole? If so, yes, I will do it.
That seems clear. Nick, you're a rocket man. What did you consider?
Yes, I am. And by the way, I want to tell you, in LA, it's cold as hell, Matt, and not a place to raise the kids. So I watched a fantastic new documentary by David Alvarado and Jason Sussberg, who had previously made The Immortalists, which people might have seen, about people striving to increase or extend viable, good human life to hundreds of years. Wonderful work. But they have a new documentary out called We Are As Gods, which is about the life and legacy of Stuart Brand, the merry prankster who started the Whole Earth Catalog, who became one of the early conceptualizers of personal computers as liberating devices, opposed to mainframe computers, which were instruments of domination by big government and big corporations of individuals, who founded in the 90s, in the 80s, founded The Well, one of the first online communities that was quite successful, and a demonstration project of what cyberspace could be. He was a hero of Wired. He created the Long Now Foundation, which seeks to get people to think in terms of 10 or 20,000 years as a way of focusing attention on what really matters. And he's now involved with a group called Revive and Restore, which is trying to de-extinct the American chestnut tree, the woolly mammoth, the passenger pigeon, and other extinct species. Brand is a fascinating character. He has certain libertarian sympathies, but is not libertarian and calls himself now post-libertarian, is very concerned about climate change, but is mostly what I find him incredibly inspiring because he's pro-technology and he understands more than most people that humans are defined by their tool making and tool using. And unlike a lot of people who are kind of in the techno culture sphere and techno utopianism or hippie counterculture, at one point in the movie, he's called the Johnny Appleseed, the intellectual Johnny Appleseed of the counterculture, which I think is a really good description of him. He's pro-technology, and he cannot imagine a world, and he's right about this, where humans are not using technology both to, make it possible for billions of people to live in better and better circumstances on Earth, to fix any issues that are caused by fuel consumption. You need more technology, not less of it. And We Are As Gods is, if you go to the website, weareasgods.com, you can figure out how to watch it and stream it. It's a fantastic documentary that is very much of the moment when we have right-wingers and left-wingers of all sorts who are trying to shut down technology, whether it's social media or whether it's fossil fuels or whether it's nuclear power, you name it, or other types of communications. Excellent documentary and fascinating and critical. It's not simply a hagiography of him. Wonderful documentary.
Can I actually pop in and tag something onto my recommendation, which is that Liftoff was a recommendation from a roundtable listener. I got an email to the Roundtable account and to me from my guy, Brian Scherer, who was listening to the Roundtable and reading this book and said, I got to hook a gal up. So just want to put a bid out there. I am absolutely accepting recommendations for books from Roundtable listeners. And I appreciate this one, Brian.
Suderman, do you have a rule of three wackadoodle engineer to add to this list?
I do have an a recommendation or two, actually. That draws from Nick's little monologue about how humans are products of the tools they make. So this week, I watched two streaming superhero epics, Zack Snyder's 4-hour and 2-minute cut of Justice League on HBO Max, and the final 7 episodes of WandaVision on Disney Plus. And both are projects that just wouldn't work on the big screen in the traditional feature format. They are entirely products of the form, streaming television, and the kind of episodic sprawl that it allows and even selects for. Snyder's Justice League is basically a fan theory come to life. It transforms a truly, truly awful 2-hour superhero movie that was just
makes it into a truly awful 4-hour superhero movie
that Joss Whedon slapped together after Snyder left the project due to a personal tragedy. And it turns it into something that I don't know if it's good, but it's really interesting. It's less a movie and more of a miniseries about gods coming to the planet Earth and what that would be like. And the gods just happen to be superheroes. And because streaming allows for longer products than the traditional feature format, even though we've gotten to the point where superhero movies can easily be 3 hours long in the theater, what you get to see here is the sprawl and scale of a director's vision in a way that just doesn't ever make it to the big screen. And then you've got WandaVision, which is a 9-episode kind of incredibly intricate parody of the last 50 or 60 years of TV sitcoms. And it takes the Marvel Universe to television in a way that I think is really quite audacious, just adapting all of this kind of sitcom stylistics to the superhero format, as if to brag that, you know, the Marvel Universe, which has always experimented with genre, can consume and transform any aspect of Hollywood into something Marvel-y. It's not quite perfect, but it's really quite impressive, and it largely sticks the landing in terms of emotional connection, narrative and character development on a show that really could have just been like a simple gimmick. And it's so strange to think these things really couldn't have existed a decade ago. Netflix had barely dipped its toe into original programming in 2011. Disney Plus and HBO Max didn't exist even 3 or 4 years ago. And now we have, just in the last month or two, both of these things, you know, which are in their own way fully realized products of our streaming video, not future, but present. And they're formal innovations that make use of a relatively new and interesting technology in a way that I found kind of intriguing and interesting.
Can I point out, I draw the line at Asylum for the Martian Manhunter in the Justice League. He should not even be given a hearing at the border. He should just be denied entrance.
He's an illegal alien?
Ultimately. The ultimate illegal alien.
It's no fun. It is no fun. My recommendation is specifically geared towards two groups of people. One is parents, and two are people who do not yet live in Florida and Texas and other places that are open. So I, on Friday night, like people do sometimes, or used to do sometimes, did something that I haven't done in a long time, which is go inside a bar, like a place that has like a pool table in the back and graffiti on the walls, and the bartender does not serve daiquiris, and the floor is sticky, and the jukebox is playing Blondie, and it was so great. I had a really banal a breakthrough observation while talking to a couple of Reason and Reason adjacent people, just a rambling, very unstructured conversation that was not like set within a 1-hour Zoom window. Like in the same way that we tell the Lenore Skenazy view of child rearing is like unstructured play is very important for children, which is something that we've all learned as parents during COVID as well, when that was sort of taken from them. Well, unstructured play is important for adults. I haven't had a lot of unstructured play in a while. And sitting indoors in a bar with people slurping down Manhattans is a beautiful, unstructured play. And I look forward, my exit strategy of COVID is going to involve a lot more of that type of behavior. That's all the unstructured play we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. please keep sending us your emails at roundtable@reason.com, including recommendations of stuff that we might read, watch, listen to, etc. For me, it's mostly listened to. And look at all of our podcasty offerings at reason.com/podcasts, including the interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesdays and the Soho Forum on Fridays and whatever other days, etc. Okay, goodbye.